Chapter 17. Alone in Rajin. After these last surprising deportations, life in Rajin never returned to normal, but instead it remained tense. Any belief in German promises had vanished. We became aware of the hopelessness of our existence. There was no complete Judenrat anymore. Only Liechtenstein and Grünblatt were still there. Jewish police and Jews who had worked for the Gestapo also disappeared during the deportations. Jakob Ponchak and his friend Rosenzweig, who worked in the stables of the Gestapo and who had been warned, were able, with great luck, to flee. They hid at the former mikveh, the ritual bath. I lived nearby and provided them with food for several days, as long as this was possible, until they disappeared and went underground. Ponchak survived the war but later died in Israel. Some of those who were able to hide during the deportations reappeared, but it was not long before they were sent in convoys to Mijerecek. As I learned later, my child and her aunt were part of one of those transports. In the town, one soon started seeing rows of workers. This time they were not Jews, but Poles and Ukrainians. After the resettlements, the houses of Rajina Jews were empty, and their apartments were picked clean. The synagogue was filled with furniture, household goods, clothing, etc. The Wehrmacht, who were stationed there before, were long gone, along with their horses. Everything was sorted according to quality. Valuables had disappeared. They were sent home ins Reich, or landed in the black market. Some items were distributed among non-Jews or burned. For us 60 or 70 remaining Jews, it was a traumatic experience to witness our own liquidation. For the Nazis, and particularly for the Polish anti-Semites, it was a happy, long-awaited day. In the evening at dusk, we saw shadows of people, probably Poles from outside the town, with sacks under their arms on their way to loot. Those days belonged to delinquents and anti-Semites. Juliet, Juliet, evil winds, today is your time, was the apt way a Jewish song put it. It looked like the end of a town, a people, a civilization, or perhaps mankind. I do not know which. It was an end, in any case. Our chevra had been more or less spared by this action. The Kamizetsky's children and I stayed in Rajin as useful Jews, but their mother had already been sent to Mijek. The Gellerman brothers and a few others were in Suchowola. One weekend we met in my little house, which was more like a hut, for the first time. Shortly before the deportations, my family had been forced to move, so that I was living alone in the ugly wooden shack close to the mikveh and other former Jewish public facilities. In some days the stench was intolerable. Nonetheless, the hovel was well situated on the edge of town, enabling us to leave at night without being seen. This fact fit in ideally with our plans. We always discussed the latest situation, agreeing that day X was coming, and that our only last chance, if there was one, of survival was with forged Aryan papers. With these documents one could either disappear in a big city or go to Germany as a foreign worker. The latter was especially difficult since it was forbidden to Jews, and if one registered for a transport with Aryan papers as a Pole, one was almost invariably recognized as a Jew by the Poles and handed over to the Gestapo. We thought it extremely risky to try to hide in the forests or villages. Many had tried it, and most had failed and were caught by the Gestapo. Aryan papers were an absolute necessity for any rescue attempt. We all tried to get them. All preparations were made. The passports and documents were ready. We stayed together the entire night, ate something, and drank vodka. The vodka was not imbibed for pleasure, but rather as a means to avoid thinking about what was still to come and what we already left behind us. Our chevra still managed to get together to talk for hours. Those were hours of cheshbon hanefesh, soul-searching. Those councils became an enormous moral support for all of us. We talked about a secret leaflet, good news about the war, or successful acts of sabotage against the German military and extermination machinery, which, unfortunately, was still brutally strong and quite intact. We were happy about these things, but we knew that each of these activities amounted to no more than a mosquito bite. Although all of us were disappointed and bitter, we encouraged each other and tried not to give up hope. Since almost every Chevar member had lost his family, we became an ersatz family, united by a common fate and a common struggle for life and survival. And, considering the hopeless state to which we were condemned, we were sentenced to remain together until death would part us. Everything each of us owned belonged to all. We lived as in a commune in true harmony, willing to sacrifice all for one another. Although in the past we had dreamed of resistance and of the rescue of our people's honour, or of the future after the war, we knew now, after the Wannsee death sentence, that a Jew could only have one goal, namely to save his own life and the life of any other Jew. With our new Polish identity cards, we felt strengthened in our resolve, in spite of all the risks and dangers. At such a time, the will to survive often demanded an enormously high price, since it usually implied certain selfish instincts to which morality and humanity were sacrificed. One's own survival was sometimes secured by placing others at risk. The Nazi annihilation apparatus was actually based on an awareness of human weakness, egoism, and amorality. For exactly these reasons, many Jews were faced with difficult moral dilemmas resulting from the will to survive. Those untold persons who passed such tests of sacrificial courage about their own deaths belong among the most holy of people. Many members of the Judenrat and the Jewish police did not pass this difficult, basically inhuman test. In their naivety and weakness, they trusted the murderers and in essence became their accomplices. In order to save their own lives or make them bearable, they became blind and unscrupulous, forgot, overlooked, and finally sacrificed their own fellow sufferers. I think that I owe it to my chevra to stress that in this period of horror we never ceased helping each other to preserve our morals and humanity. This became a guideline for my life at that time. The tension among the last 70 Jews in Rajin did not vanish. News followed rumors in rapid succession. Word of another action leaked out. According to the rumors, only 25 to 30 of the remaining Jews would remain in Rajin, and even they would be imprisoned. This meant working under guards during the day and being brought back to the local prison at night. It was to be a safe life, but without freedom, and totally dependent on mercy, always fearing the Endlösung. Until then, we had worked at large, each of us having his own place to live. When this plan became known, our chevra met again, and we decided that we would not submit to imprisonment. We were not willing to be deceived again. I had never talked to Simon, the son of the elder of the Jews, and now my protector, about our chevra and our plans. It was not so much out of lack of confidence as out of skepticism about our plans. Members of the Judenrat and their families should not know about them, nor did they want to know, because I did not intend to put up with imprisonment, and told that to Simon, quite frankly, he felt free and relieved. He had thought that I would ask him for help in avoiding his fate, and for that even his connections would probably not have been enough. During such times there was never a dearth of surprises, about which one often did not know whether to laugh or cry. One of these surprises was that Simon, according to his father's wish, was to marry Angia Weinapfel before she was incarcerated. Miss Weinapfel was well-educated and good-looking. She spoke Polish only, and that seldom and only to a few people. In every way a spoiled girl. She worked in the labor office, Arbeitamt, and was regarded as useful, and because of her friendship with Simon, privileged. It is true that many young people married during the war, but that was when there was no Treblinka or Endlösung. Now that death was everywhere, the situation was different. Was it better to die married? A wedding and a honeymoon in prison? Among my chevra, we really did not know what to think. It reminded us of the scenes from the dramas The Dybbuk, or Josie Kalb, where the wedding ceremony, as well as the expulsion of the Dybbuk, the ghost of a dead person, took place in a cemetery. Since that country was just one big Jewish cemetery, I do not know whether the planned wedding actually took place. By that time, I had already disappeared with my friends. Something strange happened to the two Kamienetsky sisters, too. A Gestapo official named Burger, in whose hands many Jews with Aryan papers had landed, came to the sisters one day. They had once sewn clothes for him and his family, and he warned them against procuring Aryan papers and trying to flee. He guaranteed to protect them for the duration of the war, but no one trusted a Gestapo official anymore. Moreover, all preparations for the sisters' escape to Warsaw were ready. A few days later, they disappeared with the chevra in the direction of Warsaw. Was Herr Burger broken-hearted? No one knew whether his intentions were good. As fate would have it, the sisters later fell into his hands again. About 25 Jewish persons in Rudzin, the last of what had been 5,000, did let themselves be voluntarily imprisoned. Not one of them survived.